Good morning. It's 9 after 6 on Wednesday, August 13th. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. Iraq has one of the largest refugee problems in the world, and my guest this hour says it's being overlooked. And he also says that fixing the humanitarian situation in Iraq should be a top priority, ahead of timetables on troop withdrawals. Joining me by phone this morning is Eric Gustafson, Wisconsin Gulf War veteran and founder of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center, or EPIC, in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit organization promoting humanitarian action for peace in Iraq. Good morning, Mr. Gustafson, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Glad to be here, John.
What is the humanitarian situation in Iraq?
Well, I thought about this a lot this morning, in terms of how to describe it so that it really drives the message home for your listeners. And I think the best way is to imagine this. Imagine if you consider the combined population of the states of Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin, that's about 29 million people. Well, that's equal to the total population of Iraq. Now, in terms of size, if you were to superimpose Iraq on those three states, it would cover 75% of the territory. Now, within that area, imagine the mass displacement of Chicago's entire population. As well, imagine that the entire populations of Detroit and Milwaukee flee to neighboring states. That is the scale, the magnitude of the displacement crisis in Iraq. Over 2.8 million Iraqis have been internally displaced, and more than 2 million have fled to neighboring countries.
Well, the nearest analog to that in the United States in terms of our experience that I can think of is the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, when we had millions displaced or nearly that in New Orleans and vicinity, and we had trouble handling that. It's hard to even imagine a problem that's that many orders of magnitude larger.
Exactly. And, I mean, in addition to the Iraqis who have been displaced, there's also a lot of extremely vulnerable Iraqis who still live in their homes, still live in their cities and villages, but they live in fear of starvation. Many go to night hungry. I believe the latest estimates from the UN are that over 4 million Iraqis are food insecure. And so that's one of the challenges. And meanwhile, while you have a humanitarian crisis of that kind of urgency and that magnitude, it's just not talked about here in the United States.
Well, the focus has continued to be on the military aspect of what's going on in Iraq, vis-a-vis whatever insurgent group we're fighting today, and the future of troop numbers and so forth, and the political situation. You're right; you just don't hear news stories about the humanitarian aspects of this situation. When I read some of these statistics, 70% of the people in Iraq do not have access to safe drinking water?
That's right. I mean, that really goes, again, to the breakdown of infrastructure across the country. And it's unfortunate because, as Americans will know, the United States had a huge reconstruction program. It was financed not only by, billions of dollars of our taxpayer dollars, but also by Iraqi oil revenue. And it really didn't get the results that had been envisioned. As a result, you still have, millions of Iraqis that don't have access to clean drinking water. There have been outbreaks of infectious disease, especially waterborne diseases like cholera and typhoid fever. Those are ongoing challenges that Iraqis are facing. But to make matters worse, because of the displacement crisis, you've had a lot of Iraqis flee the country who are so needed for the rebuilding of the country, for to provide health care to the people. It's estimated that half the registered doctors in Iraq have fled the country. And if you look at all Iraqi professionals, there's some estimates as high as 40%, that 40% of Iraqi professionals, these are people who hold degrees that are extremely needed within the government ministries, within the directorates, within municipalities. About 40% have fled the country. So that really, becomes a huge challenge to not only meet growing humanitarian needs and to try to get the development of Iraq back on track, but then to have lost so much of your human resources, your human capital that can get the job done at the same time.
Well, it sounds like the Iraqi middle class has pretty much been gutted, and that's a story that I did hear about, but not recently. And we'll talk more about that, and we'll talk about why we haven't been hearing this story on American media. And we'll do that on the other side of the weather break. We're going to check the weather around the state of Wisconsin, see what kind of day we're all going to have. And when we come back, we'll talk some more about this situation, the humanitarian situation in Iraq with Eric Gustafson. We also welcome your phone calls and participation. You can reach us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. 263-1890, please, if you're calling from Madison, 263-1890. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. What do you think? Why aren't we hearing about this? And is this something that you care about? Or do you say, well, you know, fortunes of war and all that, I don't know. Call in and let us know what you think. Let us know what you think we ought to do about this situation. And whatever, you can reach us by phone or email, and we crave your participation. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 17 minutes after 6 o'clock, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine this week. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. Cooking at home today is not just a way to save money on the family budget, but also a way to preserve the family dynamic. On At Issue after 5, Ben Marins and his guests discuss how to reintroduce the regular family meal. This hour, we're talking about a place where regular family meals are probably fairly rare for a lot of people who struggle to just find enough food to eat, clean water to drink, and so forth. We're talking about the humanitarian situation in Iraq. And my guest is Eric Gustafson, Wisconsin Gulf War veteran and founder of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit organization promoting humanitarian action for peace in Iraq. Well, Eric, why aren't we hearing this story? Why aren't we hearing about the situation for the average Iraqi civilian on our media?
Well, first and foremost, it has to do with the nature of the crisis. The Iraqis who have fled to countries like Syria and Jordan, they don't have legal status within those countries, so they go into hiding. They also they mostly go to urban areas. And because of the nature of that displaced population, a lot of them are middle class. They're able to blend in with the local population. But primarily it's that lack of legal status. They're afraid to be seen, and therefore, it's extremely hard to access those populations and get assistance. Even though many of them were middle class, they've run through their life savings, and they're becoming more and more desperate because, you know, many of them were displaced as far back as 2006. But it's because you don't have those, you know, the way when most Americans hear the word refugee, they think of the encampment, you know, of the tents. You don't have that here, so it's. The media, I think, hasn't been as good in terms of reporting the story because it's a much more challenging story to report. But there's other reasons. I mean, to this day, you know, despite Iraqis making up the second largest displaced population in the world, again, that's ahead of Darfur, and the only other country that has a larger displaced population is Afghanistan. But despite being the second largest displaced population in the world, you know, to this day, President Bush has not said the words Iraqi refugee. It's as though combining those two words are just not in his lexicon, and I think that's a real problem. I mean, we've seen some progress on the part of others within the administration, particularly folks like Sam Whitten at the State Department, who runs the Population, Refugees, and Migration Bureau for the State Department, has been doing an extraordinary job. But we absolutely need leadership coming from the very top. And to this day, you know, President Bush has not said the words Iraqi refugee.
But I mean, in addition to the refugee problem, there's a serious humanitarian problem within Iraq itself. And as you pointed out, lack of Iraqi doctors, because about half of them have left the country. and continuing problems with infrastructure, water, sewer, electricity, and things like that. We don't hear a lot about that either.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think what we've seen over time is less and less reporting coming from inside Iraq. You know, I mean, we're right now in the midst of an election year, and what we find is that all of the media coverage, or much of it, is through that political lens of Obama versus McCain. In fact, when we had the big conference here back in April, you know, we had hundreds of people come from across the country. It was an incredible full-day forum, and I encourage your listeners to go to the website that was created for it. It's iraqactiondays.org. But even though, you know, we had ambassadors, we had senior officials, we had UN experts who were coming from the region, we had Iraqis, despite the value of that event, we got almost no media coverage. And what we found is when we were, you know, doing the outreach, a lot of the media outlets said, you know, well, what does this have to do with the presidential election? And I think that's the challenge because, you know, and I would actually challenge both of the candidates and the media and the American people to really demand that we have a broader conversation about Iraq. Because in the end, you know, things like immediate withdrawal versus stay the course, I mean, that's about brand images, that's marketing. It's not really about solutions. And I think that's what we need to have a broader conversation about. What would a solution look like? We've seen progress in the last year. There's been a reduction in the violence. Even though millions have been displaced, we aren't seeing the same rate of displacement that we saw a couple years ago. So we've got, I think, a window of opportunity to really start to turn things around. And what we really need to have is a real conversation about what sustained security would look like in Iraq. What can the U.S. do to support sustained security? And through that, then meeting humanitarian needs, creating the stability so that U.S. forces can draw down. Because what's odd about the debate over Iraq is that there actually is quite a bit of consensus that I find talking to, you know, responsible policymakers, members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. I think of Representative Paul Ryan and Representative Kirk there in Wisconsin, who we've had conversations with. I think the consensus is that having Iraq's security depend on a heavy U.S. military presence of over 150,000 troops is not sustainable. And so, again, the conversation needs to be about how do we start to create sustainable security so that we can draw down U.S. forces, so that Iraqis' humanitarian needs are being met, and so that we can eventually have a peaceful, prosperous Iraq.
What's at stake here if we don't get the job done?
Well, you're talking to a Gulf War veteran. You know, when I was there in the region in 1991 and returned to the United States, I felt that we would be going back. And, you know, years later, we ended up going back. I think that's the problem is twofold. One is if we fail to support sustainable security in Iraq, then as U.S. forces pull out, we could leave another vacuum behind. We could see the return of the civil war that we saw in 2006 going into 2007. I mean, it would, you know, be the kind of violence that we saw before and the kind of displacement we saw before. Syria and Jordan, I don't think, can handle another wave of refugees like they saw in 2006, 2007. And, you know, we would see incredible chaos across Iraq. And that would be, I think, a huge challenge, not only for international security, it would be another huge setback in terms of America's standing in the world.
We've got some callers who want to join us, and we'll go first to Diane in Madison. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I recently talked to a person who was sent over to Iraq, and he said that there's a lot of financial disparity. He talked specifically about there are people in Iraq who live in castles and have lots to eat and are financially well off. And then he said on the flip side of that coin, he saw people living in tents, people who didn't have anything to eat, people who had no drinking water, and he thinks that we should not leave Iraq because, and I agree with your guest, because we have a lot of work to do over there. He also is going back. He got assigned a second time. He signed up to go back a second time, and he said, in his words, quote, "I think the United States and other countries should make things right over in Iraq because those people really need our help." So thank you very much.
And thanks for the call. Erica, not much to comment on there. You would agree with everything she said, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that it's I don't want to be pigeonholed that I'm saying that the U.S. should stay in Iraq. It's more about what would it look like if we were to have a clear strategy going forward to support the development of sustainable security. We've seen a reduction in violence, and that's good, and it's important to build on that. But we now need to, I think, have a more comprehensive strategy that doesn't just depend on the presence of 150,000 or more U.S. troops, but begins to move on the economic side, on the humanitarian side, on the diplomatic side. And I think that kind of rebalancing of U.S. policy would be far more cost-effective and would allow U.S. forces to draw down sooner rather than later.
Well, the United States has about, what, almost $1 trillion invested in the war, I wonder how much of that has been spent on any kind of humanitarian effort. We saw the massive construction program that turned out to be a multi-billion-dollar boondoggle at the beginning, but since then, what's been going on?
Well, you're precisely right. I mean, I think the economist Joseph Stiglitz puts the number at, what, about $650 billion, with a B, dollars have been spent on the war. If you look at total humanitarian spending, we're talking about a tiny sliver of that. It would be hundreds of millions of that. If you look at the effective development assistance that's going to Iraq, and I differentiate between, I think, the reconstruction program that was incredibly mismanaged from the beginning. If you look at the effective development assistance being provided to Iraq right now, and extremely important right now is technical assistance to ministries and directorates and municipalities that are helping to build up the capacity of those government agencies to meet the needs of their own people. And then also out in the field, you have the work of NGOs, organizations like Mercy Corps and International Medical Corps, that are doing absolutely phenomenal work. In fact, I think your listeners will appreciate this, the difference between development assistance that's being funneled through the military. And I'm not saying that it's not important. I mean, in terms of if you consider a military strategy and they talk about hearts and minds campaigns, and I can understand how that can be part of a military strategy in terms of short-term gains. However, when funds are going through the military through the commander's emergency relief fund or program, the SERP money, it almost is like handouts.
We're going to have to come back to that point because we're at news time. So hold that thought. We'll get back to it as soon as we catch up on news from around the world and our state. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardee, and this is the Ideas Network. It's 6:35. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. Our topic this hour is the humanitarian situation in Iraq. Millions of refugees and displaced people and a terrible situation with infrastructure within the country itself. There's lots of suffering going on there, and it's going to be a long road to hoe to get this problem fixed. To help us sort through the issue and give us an idea of what's really going on there and what needs to be done about it, I'm joined by Eric Gustafson, Wisconsin Gulf War veteran and founder of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit organization promoting humanitarian action for peace in Iraq. Well, Eric, one of the news stories that's emerged in the near past, the Iraqi government seems to have a budget surplus. What are they doing to take care of their own problems?
You're right. There's a GAO report out about the accumulated budget surplus that Iraq has over the years, it could reach as high as $79 billion by the end of the year. That assumes that the Iraqi government doesn't go forward on an emergency supplemental budget. The Iraqi government has the financial resources. The problem is a lack of human resources and capacity at the local and national level. So I think there's going to be an ongoing gap going forward in terms of the government of Iraq actually delivering those essential services to the Iraqi people, not to mention securing the country.
So, in other words, the fact that most of the middle class and the professional class have left the country is going to make it harder for the Iraqis to effectively spend the capital they do have.
Exactly. And also, it's politicized the bureaucracy in Iraq, because when you look at those who have been displaced, those who have fled the country, these are the professionals who are not sectarian. They were not being paid off by the various factions. And so that also creates a challenge. So as you start to build up that capacity and you start to create enough security so that some of those professionals can return to their homes, return to their jobs, they'll be facing challenges within those bureaucracies because of those who have ascended to higher positions in their absence.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number you can use to join the program. There's still a line available for you. You can call us in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Emails are always welcome. talk@wpr.org is the address. Let's go to the phones and take a call from Matt in Appleton. Matt, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Yes, thanks. Nice job as usual, John.
Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to the topic of the presidential cycle and Iraq reportage generally. Because the Iraq war is more closely associated with the administration and the Republican Party, I have a feeling the media might be reluctant to report catastrophic elements of the Iraq war to avoid appearing partisan.
Well, I mean, at the same side, it's also interesting that there's less reporting on progress that's been made. And one could make the same argument that that also could be for partisan reasons. I think the primary reason is just more of a focus on the domestic debate as we go into the presidential election. And at the same time also, because it did become so dangerous in Iraq, because it is so expensive for major media outlets to maintain foreign correspondents on the ground in Iraq, I know we've heard from NPR, you know, how much it costs for them to maintain their team in Baghdad and other areas of Iraq. That creates, I think, a challenge. And what I would hope to see is that we begin to see that reversed, to see more and better reporting going on in Iraq and also in the region, and also to see the candidates start to talk more about solutions, to see the media start to focus more on solutions.
Well, refugee problems and the problems of the poor and the hungry aren't as sexy as reporting on the latest roadside bomb or some other attack. And the adage in the news media has been, if it bleeds, it leads. That is not necessarily true for all news organizations, but there's a lot of excitement around the presidential campaign. And unless the candidates start talking about this issue, you're just not going to get there's not enough oxygen left in the room to cover everything else. Let's talk about the candidates. How do you assess where the presidential candidates stand on this issue? Has either John McCain or Barack Obama taken a moment to talk about the humanitarian situation in Iraq and what they would do about it?
Well, I mean, there's things that I like about both candidates, and there's concerns I have about both candidates. I mean, starting with McCain, he was one of the leading war critics within the Republican Party, calling Donald Rumsfeld one of the worst secretaries of defense that will go down in history, and really criticizing how the administration failed to have the kind of plan and the number of troops at the very beginning of the occupation to get to secure and protect the civilian population. But in terms of McCain, my concern is that just like President Bush, he has not said the words Iraqi refugee. He has not addressed enough about the humanitarian concerns. In terms of Obama, you know, what's good about Obama is that he does talk about a rebalancing of U.S. policy on Iraq, what needs to happen on the diplomatic side, on the humanitarian side. But again, I think he could still do a much better job. He could begin to talk more in terms of detail. And, you know, I think that's always a challenge with candidates. They, again, it's more about the rhetoric and marketing. And you have to really press and challenge them to offer, you know, the details of a plan.
Well, detailed plans don't make good sound bites. And everybody speaks sound bite during a campaign.
Yeah.
Let's go back.
But going back to the idea in terms of stories to report, you know, I started talking about how, and I think all Americans recognize how ineffective the Reconstruction program was in the early days. But what's not being talked about, you have, again, organizations like Mercy Corps, International Medical Corps, and others who are on the ground. And the reason why their development work is so effective is because it's community-led development work. In other words, they go into the communities, they work with the communities, the Iraqis then identify what their development needs are, and then they work as genuine partners with the Iraqis. It's so effective that in some of the cases, if you look at these projects that they've undertaken, the Iraqi community actually kicked in some of their own labor, some of their own resources, up to 20 to 40% in some of the cases with the projects. You just don't see that kind of effectiveness or that kind of partnership when development funds are you know, goes through the military, where it's more about a military strategy and short-term gains.
We're talking about the humanitarian situation in Iraq, and there's an open line for you right now at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. And if somebody gets to it before you do, then feel free to send us an email. Here's the address, talk@wpr.org. We're talking about the humanitarian situation in Iraq and how bad things are there. You've got a huge displaced population. They've fled to neighboring countries or wherever they could get to. This represents a good portion of the professional and middle class in Iraq, and that has only made it harder to reestablish some kind of normal situation within the country itself. And so one of the things we're going to spend, I hope, the rest of this hour doing, besides taking phone calls, is talking about what the United States needs to do next in order to correct this problem. My guest by phone this morning is Eric Gustafson, Wisconsin Gulf War veteran and founder of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center, or EPIC, in Washington, D.C. That's a nonprofit organization promoting humanitarian action for peace in Iraq. Again, our phone numbers are 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. Either one of those will work. And you can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're going to take a break and check the weather around the state of Wisconsin and find out what kind of day we can all expect. And then when we come back, we'll talk some more with Eric Gustafson and with you if you decide to call in. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. Next hour, can we drill our way out of high oil prices? And could we start under Lake Michigan? Well, that's the topic coming up after 7. This hour, we're talking about the humanitarian situation in Iraq with Eric Gustafson, Wisconsin Gulf War veteran and founder of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center in Washington, D.C. That's a nonprofit organization promoting humanitarian action for peace in Iraq. We have a nearly full phone bank, so we'll start to take calls, and we'll begin with Virgin in Germantown. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask what we as citizens can do to get more publicity, and where is our Congress on this issue? Are we getting any support from them? Is there anything on the horizon by way of help from them?
That's a great question, Virgin. I would say that there's a lot that people can do. I mentioned some of the organizations that are on the ground doing some of the most effective development work in Iraq and how sustainable security goes hand in hand with sustainable development. for if folks are out there interested in supporting those organizations, they can learn more through the IraqActionDays.org website. There's a full list of all of those agencies, and I really encourage listeners to learn more about those organizations and to, you know, decide which one is the best match for them and to support that organization. Just like we need to support the troops, I'm a veteran, and I strongly believe that. We also need to support those agencies, civilian agencies that are working with Iraqis and so incredibly effective. In Congress, there actually has been some movement. Senator Kennedy has been a leader in terms of addressing the needs of refugees, and there's now a commitment from the administration, I think, as a result of congressional pressure, to resettle 12,000 vulnerable Iraqis here in the United States this year. These are the most vulnerable Iraqis who simply can never go back home because of threats against their lives. And in addition, in the House, there's now legislation that's just been introduced by Congressman Alcee Hastings of Florida and others, and that it's basically a comprehensive plan, humanitarian plan for Iraq. It would authorize multi-year funding for that plan. And I think one of the problems we've faced with the administration is that it's all been very ad hoc year to year. What the Hastings legislation would do is it would be a multi-year plan so we can actually develop a strategy over a period of years that would be much more effective.
Under that plan, who would handle the money? Because that was one of the big problems with the whole reconstruction thing at the beginning, after we had declared that this thing was done with in terms of the major military conflict, little did we know.
Yeah.
But the initial reconstruction campaign was so incredibly badly managed by political hacks and opportunists.
Yeah.
Why should we have any confidence that the government is going to be able to spend money wisely on some future plan?
Well, I mean, in terms of the Iraqi government, you know, keep in mind that when we overthrew the regime, there was a complete collapse of the government. We failed to secure the ministries. The ministries were gutted and destroyed and looted. We then had a program of de-bathification. So any Iraqi who was had any ties to the Ba'ath Party, which was Saddam Hussein's political party, was thrown out. So you lost a lot of competent administrators that may have only had ties to the regime only just for simple survival. I mean, in so many ways, we tore the country back to year zero. And then you did have those political parties from outside Iraq. These are the Iraqi exiles that were thrown into the highest offices of government in Iraq. And that's where you suddenly had a lot of corruption. Because of that lack of capacity, if you just throw billions of dollars into a government agency and they don't have the capacity to handle it, well, then you get things like thousands of ghost employees and the money starts to walk away. The difference now, I think, is that you do have more of a capacity to work with. It's still not enough and more technical assistance is needed. But also, there are so many international agencies. I mean, the Hastings legislation, it really looks at it as a multi-year challenge, and it addresses it not only in terms of Iraq, but as a regional challenge. So this would be money that would go through international agencies like the UNHCR, International Organization of Migration, UNICEF. It would also go to the non-governmental organizations that have been so incredibly effective and have the capacity to do so much more, but are simply not getting the funding for it. And it would provide the technical assistance so that Iraq can actually spend down that budget surplus, which would be a huge multiplier effect in terms of providing for the needs of the people and creating that sustainable security that's so important.
We'll go next to Steve in La Crosse. Steve, good morning.
Yes. It's foggy here. Now, it's going to burn off on the Mississippi River. Please.
Well, thanks for that report.
What is the your feeling, or what are your feelings or thoughts on the oil company contracts that are starting up?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. I have real concerns about the powers that be in Iraq today. I don't think it truly reflects and represents the Iraqi people. And I just like so many Americans are looking forward to our next election, I and so many Iraqis are looking toward the elections in Iraq as a real opportunity to create more political space, for so many more Iraqis to be better represented within their government. But the mixed feelings I have is that I also know that Iraq's oil sector is in shambles. I mean, they're producing at higher rates, but a lot of their budget surplus has to do with just the fact that the price of oil is so high right now. They're still not producing more oil than in terms of the number of barrels per day, as the regime did. The regime actually was able to produce more. And even then, the oil sector was in shambles and in need of a complete overhaul. So that's a challenge that Iraq can't fix that alone. There's going to have to be investment, foreign investment even, in that. But it has to be balanced, because what we don't want to see is a push by, and I think there are some who want to see this, a push to privatize Iraq's oil sector, to have agreements with the government that really don't benefit the people, that allow, you know, billions of dollars to leave the country. So it's really got to be balanced, and there's got to be much stronger transparency and oversight and accountability.
We have an email from a listener named Stefan. He says, I have known about this problem for years. My first thought when we launched Shock and Awe was that some woman would be mopping the floors in Saddam's palace. She and many more common people like her would be the ones to die under our bombs. Then they would not even get counted, dismissed as collateral damage. I'm afraid that our insinuated global position makes this simply another call-in talk show topic one Americans can ponder over their coffee. Well, at last I've found someone more cynical than myself.
Well, I mean, it's you know, when I think about this, I mean, I've been doing this work since 1998, and with the 2003 invasion, there were times when it just felt so totally hopeless, and the colossal loss of lives, and you had suicide bombing after suicide bombing, you had then the sectarian violence breaking out in the streets of Baghdad. But at the same time, in terms of my military background, I also know that from day one, the military mission was fundamentally flawed. You know, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, and initially the occupation was under Lieutenant General Sanchez, who was just over his head. He was not qualified to handle that mission. And it was kill and capture the enemy. It wasn't shifting to a post-war doctrine of protecting and securing the civilian population. It was not until General Petraeus, many years later, implemented that his own strategy that the doctrine shifted to finally protecting and securing the civilian population. And if I credit anything in terms of really turning things around, that's a big part of it, as well as also what's been initiated by Iraqis themselves.
Well, Stephen's point about this being another call-in talk show topic is well taken, and I didn't mean to make light of that. I agree with him completely, but let's follow up on that. How do we make this issue more meaningful to people in this country?
Well, one is I think we need to hear more from Iraqis themselves. There are a number of Iraqi intellectuals. There's actually a gentleman who's here in Washington right now, Hassan Atiyah, who has extraordinary insights. And you know, this isn't a boring story. I mean, if you really look at the historical context and the evolution of conflict in Iraq and the aspirations of the people and how they're trying to create change, there are so many incredible stories there. And hearing directly from Iraqis would be one way of getting those stories out and making it more meaningful. And then the other side would be to hear from those who are coming back from Iraq who have spent considerable time there, whether it's an academic or it's an aid worker. I've had, you know, sit-down conversations with so many heroic people, both American and Iraqi, and, you know, it's very rare that we actually hear their stories. I do have to say, though, that NPR has been one of the places, and the Ideas Network, having grown up in Wisconsin, I know the Ideas Network well. There have been some media outlets that have done a much better job than others.
Talk a little bit about web resources where people can go to get really good information on the humanitarian situation and maybe find out ways that they can be helpful.
Well, first and foremost, it would be to go to IraqActionDays.org, because that branches out to a lot of agencies that are taking humanitarian action. So again, it's just www.IraqActionDays.org. reading.org. At that website, there's what we call a reading room, and if they go into the reading room, they'll be able to branch out to a lot of other resources and other organizations. I mean, Refugees International, Human Rights Watch, there are a lot of great Mercy Corps. There are a lot of great organizations that are doing admirable work. The other thing I would encourage is to learn more. We have just posted the entire Iraq Forum. This was the full-day conference that happened here in Washington earlier this year. And it's available online at the IraqActionDays.org website.
Eric Gustafson, thank you so much for spending this hour with us this morning.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
Eric Gustafson is Wisconsin Gulf War veteran and founder of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit organization promoting humanitarian action for peace in Iraq. This program was produced by Rob Ferret with on-air production by Michelle Kofel and Cynthia Schuster. Next hour, can we drill our way out of high oil prices? So stick around. After the news, we'll tackle another issue. I'm John Munson. In for Joy Cardine this week, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.